listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library. Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. I'm your host, Abby, a librarian at the Central Library. In this episode, we hear a recording of a virtual panel on race and representation in JMRL's collection, which took place in early August. But before we get to that, we've got book chat. All right, book chat. Let's check in on what Katie's been reading.
So I read The Revisioners. It's by Margaret Wilkerson Sexton. She's the author of A Kind of Freedom, which I think was nominated for a ton of awards a few years ago. It was her debut. I haven't read that one, but I did read this one, which is a really interesting story about race and generations and sort of the how, you know, the connection between generations and really the prejudice of the past shows up in many different ways. So The Revisioner is essentially two main characters that share the role as narrator. There is, in the present day, it's about 2017 in New Orleans, is a single mother named Ava, who she's divorced, she's got a teenage son, has lost her job, and so she's sort of, you know, struggling of what to do next. And so she decides to take a job caring for her grandmother, who was white, very privileged, but suffering from dementia and needs sort of full-time care. And so her grandmother has offered to let her, Ava, and her son stay with her so she can save up money for her own house. And then meanwhile, we also hear from Ava's, would be her great-great-great-grandmother named Josephine. And we actually hear from Josephine in two different parts of her life. The first time is in 1924, where Josephine is a grandmother at the time. She just lost her husband, so she is a landowner. She has a pretty successful farm, and she has, you know, she's freed from slavery. She has lots of children and grandchildren she's taking care of, and she has new next-door neighbors, a white family that has moved in, and she is sort of navigating that relationship with them. And then lastly, we hear from Josephine when she's just a child, when she was a slave. And we hear from her with her mother and what her mother did to keep her daughter safe and alive and eventually escape from slavery. And so it's an interesting story because on paper, I didn't think they would really come together, these different stories. But it's a really interesting look at, I think, especially motherhood and women and family, just, you know, the different generations we hear, you know, from Ava's mother herself, who, you know, and they all kind of, they share some of these sort of powerful qualities. There's a little bit of magical realism that Sexton throws into the story, which I always find really interesting, about these healing qualities and how it's been passed down through generations. And it's fascinating because you hear, you know, the juxtaposition of Josephine when she's an older woman and with having to deal with her white neighbors who get involved with the Ku Klux Klan. And then you have in the present day with Ava and her grandmother, who, as I mentioned, has dementia. And so doesn't always remember that Ava is her granddaughter. And so she'll throw, you know, like racial slurs and prejudice against her that come up and just from in her subconscious. So it's a really powerful novel, a really timely novel as well. And I highly recommend.
Sounds pretty good. I read Pandemic by A.G. Riddle. So I put this on hold just as the COVID-19 pandemic was starting to take root in the U.S. So by the time this book was available for me, I wasn't so sure that I still wanted to read it. It's about 700 pages long, and I was, you know, feeling pretty overwhelmed by all of the actual, you know, kind of terrible things that come with a real life pandemic. I wasn't sure I wanted to read about it, but I did crack it open, and I have to say that for a 700 page book, it reads very quickly. This is a thriller that begins just as an Ebola-like outbreak is starting to take place in Kenya. And it follows a few different storylines that sort of swirl around each other before they intersect. And it's all kind of set against the backdrop of this extremely fast-moving panic that's threatening the very future of humanity, really. Some aspects of this book are probably would have been a lot more surprising when it was first published 3 years ago. For instance, in it, Riddle kind of explains what PPE is, and he goes into the concept of contract tracing. So these are terms, right, that have become really kind of commonplace for us over the last 6 months or so. Other aspects of this book are incredibly engaging and new, despite the real-world parallels to the concept of the story. So you'll be swept up in a fast-paced plot that incorporates, you know, really incredible technology, substantial memory loss, the appearance of people thought to be dead, an international terror plot, and more. I can't say I would necessarily recommend this if you like to read for escapism, but if you are someone who loves a fast-paced plot that doesn't quit and keeps you on the edge of your seat, this is a good pick. If you feel comforted by stories that show just how much worse real-world problems can be, then I have no hesitation in recommending this to you. So that is Pandemic by A.G. Riddle. Next, we'll hear a recording of a virtual program held in early August. This panel, Race and Representation in JMRL's Collection, was made up of the following people. As moderator, Siri Russell, the director of the Albemarle County Office of Equity and Inclusion. Our panelists include David Plunkett, JMRL's Library Director, Angela Critics, JMRL's Children's Services Manager, Haley Tompkins, the Branch Manager of the Crozet Library, and Meredith Dickens, JMRL's Collection Manager. This virtual discussion explored current trends in collection development and material selection, how JMRL endeavors to break with the traditional white perspective or narrative and broaden its collection to ensure an inclusive body of own voices materials that fairly reflect the opinions and stories of marginalized communities. This discussion also examined how literature and media can perpetuate racial stereotypes and the challenges that libraries face in establishing a fluid and evolving collection of materials that meet the needs of ever-diverse communities seeking to speak on their own behalf.
Good evening. My name is Evan Stankovic, Adult Programming Librarian at the Northside Library, and on behalf of Jefferson Madison Regional Library, welcome to the virtual program Race and Representation in JMRL's Collection. Thank you so much for joining us tonight for this very special panel discussion, and please do remember to keep checking jmrl.org for a complete and frequently updated schedule of virtual programs for all ages. This event and all JMRL events have been made possible by the incredible and generous support of the Friends of the Library. This program is also being recorded for inclusion on the JMRL YouTube channel, so if you'd like to rewatch this program or have a friend who couldn't attend, barring any technical issues, we will try to get this posted within the next couple of days. Toward the end of the program, we will take time for a Q&A and try to cover as many questions as possible. However, if there is a pressing question during the course of the discussion relevant to the topic being addressed at that moment, please don't hesitate to ask, and we'll look for the first available opportunity to address it. With that said, I'd like to offer a very special thank you to our moderator this evening, Siri Russell, who was paramount in making this important event happen, and also to our representatives from JMRL. And I'd like everybody to please introduce themselves individually, and then we can get started. And let's begin with our moderator for this evening, Siri Russell.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I am Siri Russell. As a longtime library patron and just general fan of books, I'm really excited to be here and to be able to participate in this conversation. Aside from libraries, I also happen to really love equity and am currently employed as the director of the Office of Equity and Inclusion with Albemarle County. Someone else's turn now.
I'll jump in. I'm Haley Tompkins. I'm the Crozet Library Branch Manager and the former VLA, that's the Virginia Library Association, Intellectual Freedom Committee Chair, former. So I pass off to Angela.
Okay. I'm Angela Critics, and I am the Children's Services Manager for Jefferson Madison Regional Library, and that means that I am ultimately responsible for selecting all of the children's materials and also for guiding our collection management strategy for the children's collection.
I'm Meredith Dickens. I'm the collection manager for Jefferson Madison Regional Library. So I, similar to what Angela does for children's, I do for the whole collection. I guide decisions about what goes on the shelves and what stays on the shelves and how we take care of it while it's with us.
I'm David Plunkett. I'm the director of JMRL, which serves, of course, Charlottesville, Albemarle Green, Louisa, and Nelson. And I want to thank Siri and Evan for putting this together, and I'm excited to be here.
All right, Siri, I think we're ready to get going. Thank you.
Thank you. I really wanted to start by acknowledging this recent statement from the American Library Association, where they both accepted and acknowledged their role in upholding unjust systems of racism and discrimination against Black, Indigenous, and people of color within the Library Association. And their statement went on to pledge to build a more equitable association and library community for future generations of library workers and supporters. This really struck me as really an important statement in our conversation today, and then also just broadly in this sort of change narratives around libraries. And I know that while this conversation has recently really been elevated nationally, locally, we've had a considerable amount of engagement in these issues, especially around racial equity. And so I'm wondering if you guys could maybe start us off by talking a bit about the Jefferson Madison Regional Library mission and how it's been informed by your organization's commitment to equity and racial equity in particular.
I think I can address that, Siri, about the mission statement for JMRL, which just changed last summer. We had had one mission statement for many moons, and then last summer it got reviewed as our policies get reviewed on a timeline. It was time to review it again, and every other previous review had decided that the one that was in place was okay. But initially the push here was to get something that was more concise, something that was a one sentence statement of what JMRL's mission is, which is the end result was JMRL fosters personal growth and lifelong learning for all by connecting people with ideas, information, and each other. So that's the brief sentence that all staff should be able to, off the top of their head, although I just read it, give to the public about what JMRL does. That wasn't enough though for what our library board and our staff were interested in. We ended up having long discussions about all the values that the organization holds and how to appropriately convey that to the public stakeholders in the organization. There was so much that staff and the library board wanted to pack in there about the role of the libraries in the community, the desire to provide service from staff, wanting to get the message across that public libraries are for everyone, that JMRL is a welcoming space that provides equitable service. So we held a series of open meetings with the staff and the library board to workshop this. We came up with a list of values, which you can view on our website. The overwhelming desire was to let people know that this is their library, and the goal of the organization is service to the community. So I think those values have been informed by the library's equity work, and in turn they have informed the library's equity work since their implementation. So since those values went into place, the library has formed an equity committee, has had an all-staff groundwater training on systemic racism, and has worked implicit bias training into all new staff orientation. So this discussion is a timely one, as having a representative collection is not only within JMRL's specific collection development policies, but also is part of the organizational values as a whole.
David, I would love, and you know, I'm familiar with the groundwater training. Mm-hmm. I would love it if maybe you or someone on the panel would maybe spend a little bit of time sort of explaining what that training is about for the rest of our attendees, and sort of explaining also, you know, what that was like in your library setting. Because I know that's a pretty, can be a pretty intense experience.
Yeah, once a year, all library staff get together for a training day. It's the one chance that the 8 library branches and the bookmobile, which serve a geographic area that is the size of the state of Delaware, can get together and talk about things and learn things together. So last year we had guided training on systemic racism from a groundwater perspective. And the idea there is that it was a very data-based approach to what outcomes are for different populations and different groups of people in different systems across America specifically. So it looked at incarceration rates, and it broke it down by race, by class, by gender, any categories that you can think of for individuals in the country, and then looked at healthcare outcomes, and then looked at school outcomes, and went through most major systems that the United States has, not libraries specifically, but library tangential things, and then talked about how outcomes over time have traditionally been much lower for African-American families or individuals. So it was really, I think, eye-opening for a lot of staff to just see number after number after number that really showed a disparity in inequity in this country. And then that opened up a conversation for us about, well, where do libraries fit into that? And not only where have libraries participated in these systemic inequalities in the past, but also what we can do to help knit those together in the future.
Thank you. I saw some head nods. Did anybody else on the panel have anything they wanted to add to that? Once, twice.
I was just reading, so you want to talk about race, and that is another one of those, I mean, if you wanted to read a book that was very similar to the kind of the training that we went through, that really goes into a lot of the systemic racism that informs our society. And we have lots of copies available at the library too, and I also ended up buying a copy for myself in addition, just because it's the kind of thing that that we need to keep in the background of our minds at all times, or the forefront of our minds at all times, especially when we're approaching, you know, how to change these systems. And I am blanking on the name a little bit. I think it's Ijeoma Oluwo. Is that right, Meredith? Mm-hmm. Yes, Siri, yes. And she does a really great job of helping you understand what you can do to make a difference too. So that was helpful for me, and trying to put a library lens on that as I was reading it. I was trying to think of all the ways that I could apply what I was learning that way. So that's another, I think, a really good book that anybody can pick up that could help in to address those same issues that we learned about.
I hope that there's going to be a lot of book suggestions coming out of this conversation. So that's a good way to start, Haley. I've heard the term systemic racism being mentioned a couple of times in this conversation. I know one of the things that they do well in the groundwater training is really lay out the structural pieces to that. And I know you just used the term a moment ago, Haley, from a sort of a library perspective. And I think that's important for us, you know, when we're talking about this, considering the library, not just as an organization, but as an institution, right, that has its own history and that contributes to the structures and the systems that are in place in this community. And that sort of lays into my next question, which is in response to some of the values that are in your new document, and specifically the values talking about JMRL as being mindful of the culture and the history of this organization. I would love to hear y'all sort of expand on what that means when you talk about the culture and the history of this organization, of this institution in this region, and what you consider sort of the role of the library as an institution.
I think this is a very timely question, Siri, and I'll just throw in my 2 cents and open it up for everybody. But the library definitely wanted to be very explicit in that statement to acknowledge a past as an institution. You know, there's the library of today and what the library staff are working for, but there's a long history of service in the community. And actually, 1921 was the first public library in Charlottesville. So next year will be 100 years of public library service in the region here. So the library has been thinking a lot about, well, how do you commemorate that while also being very honest about it? It's this great American idea of we can have knowledge and education available for all, which was of course denied to large portions of the population because of Jim Crow segregation and then various other social institutions and policies throughout the years. So how can you kind of commemorate that while being honest about it? So this program is a good way to begin this conversation. The public library of today strives so hard to be free and open to the public. That service wasn't available for Black families for a long time in the area here. So that kind of by your bootstrap story about public libraries being a cornerstone to educate Americans and help them better their lot in life just wasn't available for Black families. There was a segregated library branch at the Jefferson School that opened in 1934. So that's 13 years after the first public library opened in Charlottesville. It was known as the 4th Street branch, and it was closed in 1948. So just 14 years later, basically. If you look back through the meeting minutes of the library board, which are available online, they've all been scanned and people can look through what those decisions were at the time. It was about money. Basically, the library board didn't want to continue supporting a second branch and they weren't willing to put the money that was needed into it in order to keep it open and anything close to equal. So at that point, they shuttered the Jefferson School 4th Street Library and declared that the McIntyre Library downtown was integrated. So I'm not sure how realistic that was, though. In 1948 in downtown Charlottesville, what kind of atmosphere that would be for a Black family to walk into. It always seemed to me that it really wasn't until Gordon Avenue opened in 1966 that there was a truly free and open public library to the community, because it was very clear at that point that this is an integrated institution. So at any rate, JMRL, looking to commemorate that, is working with local filmmaker Lorenzo Dickerson to make a film about the history of library service in the area that we hope to premiere next summer.
We had a question come in and it was really timely, just because we used the words commemorate a few times just now in what you were saying as we're talking about the history. And the question, or maybe sort of more of a statement, is, you know, in the current environment, there's been discussion of not identifying the regional library with the Jefferson Madison name. Is that a conversation that you guys have had at all, or is there anything that you guys can say sort of in response to where you guys are headed or considering on that topic?
Sure. Yeah, the Staff Equity Committee has been talking about this for a while, and we have had some interest from the public questions about, you know, how that decision was made and should the library reconsider that particular name or any other naming conventions there. So the library board and library staff are going to be putting together a working group this fall. Initially, questions about names that came to the library were about the McIntyre Room itself at the Central Library. So there's going to be a working group that's going to study, you know, how that name came to be and the history of that and what the path forward should be for library naming conventions, period. And I'm hoping that out of that we'll come up with some community engagement that'll help us really look at the name of the library system and figure out, you know, whether or not that's a barrier for access to people, and if so, what changes would need to be made.
Thank you. So our theme for this evening is race and representation. And so what I'd like to sort of invite you guys to say next, and I am going to put some folks on the spot and say someone other than David needs to answer this question, okay? Is, you know, what does it mean, you know, to be representative, or even to engage in a conversation around race and representation within sort of an organizational context of a predominantly white-led institution? You know, what does representation mean for you? Why is it important? And how are you going to get it with your current makeup?
I can address that from a collection standpoint. David's been speaking about the institution as a whole, as he should, as our director. But looking really at the collections, we are guided in our decision of what to put in the library collections by our policy, our material selection policy, which references the mission statement and also talks about what criteria we use to add material. And primary in that is the needs and interests of the community. So we really need to look at what our community is made up of and what they're interested in and make sure we're providing information for all members of the community to meet all of those needs. In terms of representation, we want to make sure that everyone who walks into the library sees materials that fits their needs, maybe mirrors them, allows them to see their voice in the collection and their story, but also allows them to learn about other voices and stories. So even when you are a white library patron, you need to be able to learn about people other than white people. So we need to just make sure that there is as broad a range of materials as possible. Our criteria also reference the fact that we need to back up our decisions with reviews and authoritative sources. The things that are available from the publishing world are becoming more diverse, but we need to find more avenues of maybe independent presses or independent media reviews rather than the bastions, the New York Times, who's working on trying to get more diverse reviews, but looking deeper to find the marginalized voices. And not only materials about various groups, but also by various groups. So when we use the term own voices materials, that's making sure that the authors are telling their own stories. Anyone else can chime in too.
I'll go ahead and chime in now. In children's collection development, there's a lot of talk about books as both mirrors and windows, and also looking at them as sliding glass doors. And so the idea of the book as a mirror is that child comes into the library and they see themselves. And I've seen that in person with a family come in, that they see, they pull out this book and they're not expecting to see themselves. And the joy on that child's face when it's, this reflects my life. It's huge. That needs to be there. But the window helps other patrons to see that other person's life. So it's my mirror, but for you, you get a view of me. And ideally, we move beyond that to sliding glass doors, where this is a way for them to begin to engage with people who are different than them. And it's hugely important, because if you are the child who is the default of all of the books, you grow up thinking you are everything. It is all about you, and that anything different is suspect. And so by allowing them to have access to and interact with different cultures, different perspectives, different ways of life, it helps them build empathy and acceptance. And so that's a huge part of the philosophy of how I go about selecting books. And own voices is huge. Looking at all of the different voices of blogs and writers banding together to promote the diverse books. And that's huge. I really follow a lot of those blogs and those lists and awards to make sure that I'm pulling in a broad range of types of books for everybody.
Thank you, Angela. I was actually going to ask a follow-up to what you said, Meredith, when you talked about own voices and you talked about, you know, having to get out there. I was going to ask, you know, how are y'all doing that? You know, hopefully it's not just Angela.
No, hopefully it's all of us. Well, one of the things that we've started in the last couple of years is our Local Voices collection, which allows us to kind of bypass that traditional publishing. It's really hard to break into that world and then get your book in noticed by libraries and anybody who's buying books. So we established the Local Voices collection to highlight the voices of those in our community. So if you have self-published a book, if you put that work in, we will gladly have it on those library shelves for other people to see there and to read. And I wanted to loop back in because we were talking about library traditional as traditional institutions and more locally, the things that we can think about as librarians is not just what we put on the shelves, but also how we get people to access them. It's very frustrating to me, especially probably all of us, is I put the work in to build a collection. I wanna make sure that I have a representation of a certain community and their stories. And people say, you don't have any books on X. And I'm like, we do have these books, but they can't find them. And so one of the things we also have to worry about is how we provide access, how we catalog and classify the information so that people can find it. We do have our staff to help guide people, but we also want people to be able to find it on their own. So the language we use in our catalog, the subject headings we use, libraries traditionally struggle with this. If we use the core set of Library of Congress subject headings, some of those are problematic. They are not the names people use to describe themselves, or they are terms with a lot of baggage. We need to look at that and continuously update our catalog to use the language that's more accessible. One of the things that we hope to do soon, and I hope I can talk about this, is that to add tags to our catalogs so the community can add keywords and phrases to identify materials that's useful to them in the language that's useful to them.
I'll also say to that the way that like library branches themselves can help, you know, when we're open to the public, is displays. And it's important to know that we should have representation in all of our displays the same way that we have in our collection. So like we, in every display, not just, you know, for Black History Month, not just for, you know, Native American History Month, we should celebrate those in addition to always having something out there that represents the diversity that is in our community, the diversity that is in our country, on our shelves and on display in every part of the library. So, you know, if a display is about feminism, it should also have, it should have a diverse voice, you know, diverse voices represented in feminism and not just, you know, a bunch of white women. So, and the other thing I wanted to mention too is that in order to get representation and to reach the people that we want to reach who might not be traditional library users because they have been excluded from that world in the past, we need to reach out to those communities. And that's a big part of our programming, is to reach out to groups of people who may not have the ability to get to the library as often, might have, you know, working parents that can't get to our libraries during regular library hours. So like doing story times in schools, doing library story times in for Head Start, and informing parents on what library resources are available to those communities. We have a great program for our laundromat libraries that's also on hold right now because of COVID. But you know, those are small library collections that are in laundromats that people can access while they're waiting for their laundry to be done. We have, you know, at our library, we have a monthly visit to the food pantry. So to reach those who, you know, have a food scarcity and may not be able to have the resources to travel to our library all the time either. So there's a lot of other ways to also invite people in. And that's really, really important because people need to see themselves as mirrors when they're in the library, but they also need to be there to do that and to see those beautiful things that we have for them. When Angela was talking about the mirrors, in addition, I was thinking of, there's a beautiful poem in Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson that's just about that. She talks about the first book that she found, and she was told that, you know, in everywhere else besides the public library, she was told that that book was too babyish. It was a picture book, but it had a brown boy on it. And she was so excited to see somebody that looked like her. And it made such a big impact on her and her reading and writing life. That's the reason it's so important to have that representation and to be able to find things about yourself in library collections, because otherwise, you know, you miss out in inspiring, you know, a huge amount of people to not, you know, not be excited about books or not be excited about reading or, yeah.
Haley makes a really good point there that there's a huge population out there that doesn't see the library as a place that has anything for them, and so they never come. And it's only by our partnering with community organizations that are already serving those populations that we can connect with them in a meaningful way that helps them see that, yes, we actually do want to provide services to you. And that's a huge part of what we need to be doing going forward.
And I would also like to put a plug in for if you don't see yourself in the library collection, there is a place for you to let us know that. There is a way to suggest our purchasing not only specific titles, but titles on topics, jamroll.org/suggest. We welcome that input. You rightly pointed out that this panel is all white, but we don't make the decisions. We welcome input from other people because we recognize that we are just ourselves.
Siri, can I slide in here real quick with a question?
Of course.
One topic here. We received a question, will JMRL attempt to get more in-depth material on Black leaders who were considered troublemakers by the American government? Point in case, I'm of the opinion Minister Malcolm X, his work is often, so to speak, swept under the rug. If his work does surface, it is quick to be labeled as hate and violence. I beg to differ. I think if people understand to read and read to understand for themselves, they would draw a different light of Malcolm X than the American government would have you to believe.
And can I just say, I know this question was anonymous, but to whoever posed it, thank you. I think it's a good question, and I would agree, you know, generally with your premise. And if I can find a way to share my favorite Malcolm X quote during this conversation, I'm gonna do it, so stay tuned. is there a response to that?
Haley, could you talk a little bit about your discussion series that you had around a movie about Malcolm X as another way to expand the library's offerings outside of maybe traditional print?
It wasn't on Malcolm X. We did a series, I think it was back in 2015. And it was a grant-funded series that allowed us to show four documentaries that were on different issues of about civil rights. So actually the first one was about abolitionism and the second one was about slavery by another name. It was about the prison system in the Jim Crow South, and forced labor in Jim Crow South. And then it went all the way up through Freedom Riders. And we also, we partnered with, L.D. Perry was our moderator for that. And we hosted a lot of panelists that had discussions afterwards, which were great. A lot of them were UVA professors that were really knowledgeable on different aspects that we invited them for. And that was really, really powerful. We had, I think, 75 people for the largest one. And you know, we've done other things since then. I'm trying to think, Evan and I actually both had a program that we had at Crozet and then at Northside. And we did that with Beloved Seville. Evan, do you remember the name of that movie that we showed?
I'm Not Racist, Am I?
Yes. And that was really good because that showed I think it was mostly just teens. It was teens talking about racism. And that was a really powerful conversation too. Again, I think we'd had standing room only at the point, and that was in Crozet, which is a very, very predominantly white community. It's a really good thing to have programs as well that represent our values and to represent, you know, the kinds of issues that are so prevalent in our community right now. And so the programming piece is a really big part of it too, like Sarah mentions, that we have to have programs that involve people and invite people to talk about issues about race. And invite people to talk about and see themselves in programs too. So I know Angela has had a bilingual story time, correct?
Yes.
And yeah, so there's a lot of other programming components that come into that too.
And I think that this question sort of encapsulates some of the things that you've been discussing when we talk about, you know, how much material do you have, right, on Black leaders, be they civil rights leaders or whoever. There may be more even than what our commenter knows, and that could be connected to some of the things that you talked about before, about the visibility of some of those materials or the tagging of some of those materials. And then when you talk about the programs, I think that also relates to what Angela was talking about and what each of you were talking about being able to actually connect in the community with the folks who may be looking for some of those materials and looking for that kind of programming within your organization, within the system, and not knowing that it's there. So that actually sort of, I think, leads well into our next question, which was, you know, you guys have even mentioned this, JMRL's commitment to amplifying really a full spectrum of voices. And while we've talked a bit about your equity committee and about some of the work that you guys are doing, I'd be really interested in hearing how you're actually applying an equity lens to, you know, to the collection itself, to what's on the shelves right now.
I think this is a good time for Angela to talk about the diversity audit.
I thought that was directed in my direction. So one good way to get a snapshot of what's on our shelves right now is what's called a diversity audit. And it involves taking a section of the collection and going through book by book by book and evaluating what is the diversity represented there. And about a year and a half ago, I did that with a small section of our children's chapter books. And by small, I mean I got books whose authors' last names began with A and B. And it's such a time-intensive thing that looking at every single one of those books, it was almost 600 books. But it let me see what years and years of buying within the very white publishing system had left on our shelves, in spite of the fact that I'd been trying to purchase diversely for a couple of years. I reviewed the books for authors' gender, main characters' gender, Black or African-American characters, Latinx, Native Nations, Asian representation, LGBTQ, disabilities, religion, and by that I mean representation of non-Christian religions, and whether or not it was in own voices, was the person who wrote the story, was it their lived experience, or was it a white person writing a Black person's story? And to me, own voices can be very important that way. I found some very cringeworthy stuff. I also found some things that I thought were going to be okay that actually promoted stereotypes. So this looks like a really great series on this dance school where all of the kids are diverse, until you look at the book that's focused on the Black dancer and, oh, well, she doesn't ever want to do ballet. She only wants to do hip hop. So it's promoting a stereotype of, you know, Black dancers are only going to do hip hop. They can't be ballet dancers. We know that's wrong. So it gave me a perspective of where we were and where I needed to go from there. What do I need to focus on to fill this out? And did you want my results, Siri?
We do.
Just do people want numbers? So almost 600 books I reviewed, and of those, 5.7% had Black or African-American representation. 3.2% were Latin. 0.8%, not quite 1%, were Native perspective. 2.8% were Asian. 2.7% spoke to disability. and 5.7% were own voices. So none of those numbers are matching the diversity of our communities. So, but I can now look and see where I need to purchase going forward to try to get representation.
I think it might be useful. Sorry, Siri.
Go ahead, David. Go ahead.
Well, there's so much that we take for granted because these are all professional librarians who have been doing this for a long time. But kind of to talk briefly about what the cycle is for libraries, because we have almost 500,000 total items throughout JMRL. And it's not a static collection. There are things, sure, that Angela was looking at that have been pretty static. They've been sitting downstairs at the Central Library Children's Room for many, many, many years. But it's a constant process of ordering and withdrawing what we call weeding materials too. So this work that Angela was talking about helps on two fronts. It helps to decide, you know, to focus using our collection development policies and procedures where the money will be spent moving forward, but also to decide the things that need to move out to make room for them. Like, what is our community looking for now? You know, what are the types of things that are outdated or no longer relevant that need to be replaced? And some of it's easy. You're talking about nonfiction books about Pluto. You know, those need to go because, sadly, Pluto no longer a planet. But in general, you know, we're constantly getting new information about our own lives and our own past that nonfiction books need to be looked at there. And also just fiction books. A lot of it is also just that our collection takes a beating. I mean, it goes home with people and it goes into the bathtub and it goes here and there. So it's. I just wanted to point out, and maybe Meredith can add to that if there's anything else, but that it is a constantly evolving thing with things coming in and coming out. It's not a static set collection at any given time.
Exactly. And I'd like to say that as I identified the really cringeworthy things in the collection, I looked, well, if it's not meeting a community need because nobody's checking it out or it's damaged or in bad shape, I weeded it. I removed it from the collection. So there was a process of me identifying things because I went in and had my hands on everything to see things that did not meet the community needs any longer.
Thank you guys, and thank you for sharing those numbers, and also how that might be impactful in the future. You know, David, when you were talking about this, you know, sort of process, it actually got me to thinking about representation in other areas too. I had a conversation not that long ago with the state's Department of Historic Resources. We talked about historic markers in the county. We did an inventory of our historic highway markers. We had about 42 of them. Five of them are on topics related to a woman or a person of color. And that's pretty similar across the state. When talking to the folks at DHR, they told me in the first 50 years of the historic marker program, there were only five markers that were put forward that were related to a person of color, and hundreds of markers went up. And so when you think about sort of the transition and the expansion of these narratives and that turnover over time, it really does sort of give you a sense of time, right? Which sort of leads me then to a question for you guys, you know, to the when question, right? When can the community, like, what should they be expecting to see right now? And when should they be expecting to see transformation or some of the things that you've talked about wanting to see happen, both in the collection and in sort of representation and programs?
Well, I didn't come up with this, but I think this is not a sprint, it's a marathon, right? And we've already been talking about the things that we're starting to do. And those changes, some of them we can enact immediately, some of them we need to work through our institution to make sure they get changed. And hopefully it's ongoing and through little increments and sometimes big leaps when we can make it. I don't know if anybody has anything more concrete.
I wanted to talk to that in a couple of ways. Number one, you should be coming into our branches now and seeing that our displays just show diversity, because we have said, this is what we will do. We will do this now. So we will highlight diverse titles year round. They will be in our book list.
And while you can't come in, sorry, Angela, when you can't
I'm
come
sorry.
In, we still do have book lists and carousels on our e-library, and we are highlighting virtual displays even while our buildings are closed. Please continue.
Yes, but you should be seeing that these things are already in place. You know, at least at Central, we've got a mandate that when you do story time, at least one of your books that you use will be a diverse book that you will introduce to the families that come. We want diverse books used in our book groups for kids. So we are making efforts. We're not always going to get it right. We're going to make mistakes, but we are actively trying to do that now. The sad fact is that if I wanted to buy books that represented percentage-wise our population, our community, there aren't enough published for me to do that. And until that changes, there's a limit to how much I can change the collection, much as I want to try. And it makes me think of something that a year ago when I went to the American Library Association conference, I had the privilege of speaking with Dr. Emily Knox, who is a woman of color and is a First Amendment scholar. And we were talking about racism in children's books in particular. And she said to me, "You're not going to get balance. It's not possible to get balance right now. Strive for representation." And I try to keep those words, you know, very close to my heart as I'm trying to make decisions on what I purchase. And please, if you see I'm missing representation somewhere, tell me, because that is my goal.
I think too, it's important to know that we, the library world and the staff at in libraries across the country are also very predominantly white. And it's also really important for us to recognize our own biases in that. And we have to try every time to like make sure that we are representing voices that are not necessarily our own if we are, you know, white librarians in a white library field. And it's important for us to acknowledge our very real like issues in the library world to be able to address them in the first place. And so we started an equity committee, which I think is a good first step in the right direction to learning more how to navigate some of these problems and how to address them. And again, it is a marathon, not a sprint, but we, you know, are at least starting there so we can know what to start addressing in the first place. And I think training is also a big part of that, because if we don't inform our staff about what needs to change, then we have to get buy-in from everybody to be able to put things on display, to know what the collection, what's in our collection, to be able to promote it to people, and to be diverse in being able to do that. So there, I think first it's acknowledging what our problems are and then learning how to get over the, you know, to get past those problems or to at least start working on those problems as soon as we can. So I don't know if there's a really good answer to the when, but we're starting right now. And this is a really good panel. I think this suggestion that you had to have this discussion in the first place is a really good starting point.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, you were probably about to say the same thing I was going to say, Evan, but go ahead and say it.
The question? Uh-huh. So what are some ways you're trying to understand your biases?
Well, partially through books, through reading, and partially through training, like the, it was the Racial Equity Institute that did our groundwater training, through incorporating regular diversity training. Again, we just started a training committee. We didn't have one of those until just this past fall. And so getting that and working with the equity committee on how to train people to recognize our biases is going to be really important. So, go ahead, David.
Well, I was just gonna, you know, in a larger sense, Haley was talking a little bit about the overall profession nationally, you know, and we've mentioned a couple times the makeup, the racial makeup of this panel, and the fact that a lot of it comes down to hiring too, moving forward. It's a goal in the library strategic plan to hire a diverse management staff. But, you know, it's within my career at JMRL that the first African-American branch manager was hired. So I'm old, but I'm not that old. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And I think JMRL has laid the groundwork for that. My predecessor worked with the NAACP to come up with a scholarship for local students of color. So either high school or college students. To help them pay for schooling with the intent that they would work some at the library. So it's like a scholarship / work study program. It's been highly successful and it's gonna take years to see the dividends of that where we can start to hire back our homegrown talent. We also have a staff scholarship for non-professional staff to go to library school. In terms of diversity in the field, for the longest time it was, oh, well, our management level predominantly have master's in library science degrees. And for the longest time, there was no library school in Virginia. So it was like, oh, well, you know, we can only get what we can get because there's no library school in Virginia. Well, ODU now has a library school, just started this year. And also most of our young professional librarians that we're hiring, especially our internal ones, are getting their degrees online. So the opportunities and the pathways are starting to open up. Now it's up to JMRL to go out there and actively seek these young professional African-American librarians, don't have to be young, could be anybody, librarianship is the favorite second job for everybody. But at any rate, so the point I was gonna make is that JMRL needs to be more proactive about seeking candidates of color, basically, instead of sitting back and waiting for what comes to JMRL and maybe advertising, you know, with the Black Caucus at ALA, which we've done for a long time, but it takes more than that. And it also means looking at our salary structure and making sure that we're making it worth somebody's effort and time to move to the area if they aren't from the area in order to help make sure that we have as diverse a managerial staff as we can.
And so I think we want to open up the Q&A because I think we're getting a couple questions coming in now. And before we do that though, I wanna make sure to say this out loud. We had a commenter who noted where that really wonderful metaphor that Angela shared with us about sliding glass doors and mirrors and windows. And she noted, she shared with us the source being an essay, Mirrors, Windows, and Sliding Glass Doors by Rudine Sims Bishop, and notes that it is worth reading in its entirety and is available online. So just want to be sure that we share that with everyone else. Mirrors, Windows, and Sliding Glass Doors. Hit the Googles, you're on the computer anyway. Thank you for noting that. So I think we have a couple minutes here for Q&A, and we have a question that's really relevant to what you were just talking about. And the question is, how do you engage people of color to assist you with steering your mission?
That's a great question, because as we just mentioned, you know, if our, the managerial staff is not diverse, then it's kind of a self-perpetuating loop unless you go look for outside sources. So luckily Charlottesville as a region, you know, this whole area is full of so much talent, so many smart individuals, and no matter what field you're looking in. So we work with our government partners, you know, so we work with Albemarle County and City of Charlottesville and try to hitch on to what their initiatives are. So Siri, that means you, bringing Siri in to talk to our equity committee. We've had other folks that work for the City of Charlottesville do the same. We've liaised with local NAACP on that scholarship annually. But more than that, it means getting out of the library and getting to where people are. And our best, you know, the most kind of small community oriented branch we have is the one that travels. It's on wheels, the Bookmobile, which is currently not running also for COVID reasons. But it definitely, it's only served Charlottesville and Albemarle as opposed to the whole area, but definitely gets out into communities and neighborhoods. That's more about service though, and less about engaging people and steering the process. Libraries love to be free and open to the public. All of our meetings are free and open to the public. Since the COVID pandemic, every library board meeting is being taped and put up on our YouTube page as well. But again, that's not the same thing. That's saying it's an outdated version of what access means, to say, yeah, it's all here, just come and get it, you know, because that's relying on people somehow getting the word about services or getting the word about the needs of the library to get input. So in the past, we have done, for every strategic plan, we do surveying of the community, but it's a constant struggle to make sure that the folks that are being surveyed aren't just the library patrons that are using the services anyway, because that's another self-perpetuating loop. So it's on the library to go out there and to make these connections in the community in order to help steer this process. The biggest tool that we have to guide the future of JMRL is our strategic planning process. It's mandated by the state. It has to be every 5 years. That's a state mandate, although ours we review annually in order to update. So the next time this comes up for review is not for 4 years, but the annual updates on it happen every spring. And next year in the spring, we'll come up with a community engagement plan to come out and address some of the things that that we're talking about here today. I'm also very interested in some kind of geographic data that we have available, because we talked about other barriers to access as well. It's in our five-year plan to look at fines, whether or not that's a barrier to access, to look at other sorts of procedures that the library has that might be putting up roadblocks in front of people. So at any rate, that's a long-winded way to say that we rely on our community partners, but there's a lot more work to be done there.
And I'd just like to say that this goes back to what I said about partnering with community organizations when we're doing outreach. I can walk over to the Friendship Court Community Center and pop myself in there and think I know what I'm doing. And or I can partner with a community organization and find out somebody who's already working there and knows the needs of the community, and I can get a perspective from the community that's not going to be my own. And that's really important, that I'm talking to CHIP or Ready Kids or MACA or talking to Big Brothers Big Sisters, so that I can find out what their needs are when I plan how I'm going to respond.
Can I just tack one thing on to Angela's and then I'll be quiet, but there, JMRL does have a program partnership request form as well. So if there are organizations that are seeking to partner with JMRL, again, this is kind of what I was saying, come tell us that you want to partner. It's available there for any organization or individual that wants to partner with the library.
So I'll say, I said I was going to find an opportunity to use my favorite Malcolm X quote since he got brought up today, and here it is. My favorite quote from him is, "When I becomes we, even illness becomes wellness." And it feels like that's a bit of what we're talking about here when we're talking about community, talking about the sort of transformation of your institution and growing more collaborative, right, in spirit, really bringing that we part into your work. I for one have been really heartened to hear some of the things that you're already doing, but I'm also really excited to see the things that that you know you hope to be bringing in the future. And obviously you can count on me to help partner in trying to get that to happen. Are there more questions? If folks have a question, now is the time, right? The Q&A hotline is hot.
Yeah, type the questions in at the bottom, the Q&A box, or if you want to ask your question aloud, just click participants at the bottom of your screen and then click the raise hand button. And if you've called in tonight, you can press *9 to activate the raise hand.
Thank you, Evan. You have the perfect moderator voice.
Thank you. Not seeing any more questions, Siri.
Okay. All right. Well, if there's not any other questions, then I would love to hear if there are, someone asked a question. Do you feel like that holding a master's degree, sort of that requirement contributes with the lack of diversity in JMRL? So is the master's degree really required? Is that a barrier?
Yeah, I think it definitely has been in the past for the reasons that I laid out, you know, the difficulty in getting that degree. I think it's a little not easier. It's still a very difficult thing to do, but it's more accessible now than it was. JMRL has looked at certain positions that had in the past been master's level only and opened those up a little bit. So that we would take equivalent experience for that, including sometimes if need be at the managerial level where we're looking for that managerial experience or customer service experience, which Haley has been big on, you know, that sometimes makes up for a lack of a master's degree. It has been the traditional model for public libraries that is a requirement. But I remember my first day in library school, the first professor said, there's nothing that you're gonna learn here that you wouldn't learn in 10 years of working at a library. So I think moving forward, that's something that JMRL will definitely evaluate. For right now, as I said, we are trying to provide tools for our staff to have funding to go get those degrees because it is a requirement. But that's a great point and something that I think the institution, you know, public libraries in America are going to be looking at pretty closely in the years to come.
And I'd like to add that it's not just at the master's level. Most people don't realize it, but most of the staff that you see in the library are not degreed librarians. And so most of the staff that I have in the children's room, they're required to have a bachelor's degree. Well, even that can become a barrier. And being able to say, I can substitute 2 years of equivalent work experience for having the full degree has allowed me to have a broader pool to pull from, and I've been thrilled with the folks that I have found once I have opened up, you know, and it's a matter of us learning to look beyond what we've been conditioned to expect is necessary to do this job and be a little more open to what something, those intangible things that somebody else is going to bring to the position that really enriches what we can offer the community.
Thank you. I saw a hand go up a while ago and then go back down. So if you're still feeling frisky, you know, put that hand back up so you can ask your question. In the meantime, we have another one that's come in, which is really a question about trust building. So the question really being, how are you going to go about gaining the trust of people of color specifically in doing what you say and saying what you mean?
Well, I think that this goes back a little bit to the discussion about kind of a traditional model of libraries being like, okay, we're here, we open the door, it's free and open to everybody. We talk a lot internally in our staff about the fact that librarians saw themselves for the longest time as being a kind of gatekeeper for knowledge. Their job was to stand there, guard the knowledge, and you know, everybody thinks about the shushing librarian or whatnot, but it's also just in terms of like who could get into the building when we're talking about libraries in the South, and how that model has changed. And now we talk about access to information. That's the role of the librarian, is to connect people. Grow, learn, and connect is our tagline. So our job is to give you the information that you're seeking. In terms of building trust as to what the institution can do for the community, I think that has to do with the types of community engagement and outreach that Angela was talking about. I think folks that maybe in their mind have not seen a relevance for libraries or have felt that they were not welcome there. You know, we've got generations of families, as we talked about earlier, that the generational knowledge about libraries was that it was not available if you're Black. I read something about John Lewis gave a speech about how he went to a public library when he was a young man with his family and siblings or cousins and was turned away and told, you know, you're Black, you can't come in here. And he never set foot in the library again until he received an award from the ALA for writing March, the graphic novel. And that type of story passes on from family to family to family to say, oh, that place is not for you. So it's one thing for the library to be like, well, it is for you. Come on in. Now everything's different. But actually building that trust that question is about is more about the library going outside, making those connections, bringing what we have to offer to show to the community, and then say, you know, come on in and we'll show you the rest.
Thank you. We have Peter, I see you put your hand back up.
I'm going to unmute Peter right now.
I'm curious about budgets. We have several jurisdictions that have in the past been reluctant to support the library. And is there any movement toward better support of the library to improve the diversity, to meet some of the goals that we have talked about or that you have talked about here tonight? And I'm hoping that that's true. And I'd love to hear what kind of interactions you're having with our local jurisdictions.
I think that's probably for me to answer. JMRL is a partner with five jurisdictions, Charlottesville, Albemarle, Greene, Louisa, and Nelson. All of them strongly support public libraries in their region, recognize the value that it has for their community, and support the work that JMRL does. JMRL exists because in the 70s, the state of Virginia incentivized regional libraries, basically said, you get together, you share costs, so there only has to be one director and one Meredith and one Angela and one Haley. And we will give you money annually in order to buy books and materials, state aid for public libraries. So Peter, our local jurisdictions are extremely supportive. They have many of their own initiatives that kind of mirror what JMRL is interested in doing moving forward in their own staff and the way that they approach their work. Funding is gonna be difficult for the next little while because of the pandemic. Certainly JMRL had approved a budget for this fiscal year last year that took a hit after the pandemic because local jurisdictions just didn't have the money that they did before. So it's going to be tight for the next few years. In terms of the representation in the collection, which is what we're talking about today, the state aid has not been fully funded since 2001. JMRL receives the second most amount of state aid in the state because of the size of the state of Delaware. But it's about 60% of what we should have. So when Meredith and Angela are talking about making decisions about purchasing, I mean, for every dollar that's spent on a book, that's a dollar that can't go to another book. So that would really help to diversify our collection if we had the full range of resources that were available at the state level. State, of course, also facing some budget issues moving forward. But I would hope that if there's advocacy to be done for funding, that's a great way to focus your attention, to talk to your state legislators and say, you know, public libraries throughout the state are doing all these things for your communities. They're filling in gaps that our legislators might not be aware of, and they need help when it comes to funding, especially for collections.
Are there other ways, David, that folks can also support the library and the very real sort of economic issues that, you know, surround your ability to do things?
Absolutely. Well, join the Friends of the Library. Most of you might be aware that the Friends of the Library organization gives supports all library programming, basically. Annually pays for every program that you see at the library to the tune of tens of thousands, if not $100,000 each year. That comes from their annual book sales. They have two, one in the spring, one in the fall. Because of the pandemic, they had to cancel the spring one right when they were about to start, and there's worry about the fall one as well. So membership is important there. It's very reasonable. I think it's still $10 to join the Friends of the Library, and that those funds go to support the library. There's also on our website, there are wish lists for books. There are ways that you can purchase books directly. I know it's been problematic to try and get a lot of books about race and racial equity in the last few months because publishers, there haven't been enough. You know, you can't buy them. So anytime folks buy one of those books for us or a book that's in high demand of any sort, it's a little bit less that the library has to try to spend to keep up with demand. So check out our webpage. There's as Meredith has mentioned, you can suggest that the library purchase things. You can also, you can purchase things directly from a wish list for the library.
Since you brought up the topic of books, we have a question asking for recommended reading for learning more about race and representation. Haley?
I saw that come in too, and I just wanted to, we could spitball some titles here, but I also wanted to send you to the JMRL blog because our reference staff has done a really, really good job of creating lists that are available that are books that are available in our collection. And there are a lot of book lists there that the one that I've got pulled up is a reading list for anti-racism. It's they all have a title that says the African American experience and then a subtitle, a subgenre. And one that's just BCLA award winners, one that is Own Voices of Science Fiction and Fantasy for Adults. And there are tons of book lists on there. So I would first point people to that. And then I will make another plug for Idioma Oluo's So You Wanna Talk About Race, which is the one I mentioned earlier. And How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi, as well as I couldn't get my hands on Stamped from the Beginning, which he also wrote because there was too long of a hold list for it, but I happened across Stamped, which is the young adult reader version of that. That's actually, I listened to the audiobook of it. It was read by Jason Reynolds, who is phenomenal as a reader and as an author. And he has his own twist on that book. So he makes it very accessible for young readers. And that was a really phenomenal read too. So those are a couple recommendations from me.
Does anyone else have a recommendation? We'll move to the next question.
Haley said, it's great. I think definitely find the book lists on our website and find a genre or an area. The, you know, the top 10 bestsellers right now are all gonna guide you in ways if you wanna learn nonfiction about racial justice issues, but also just read a novel from an author who doesn't look like you, because that's gonna help with empathy, and they're all great books. So just read more.
Yes, and we can help you come up with a personalized recommendation if you use our What Do I Read Next selection, like Meredith said. If you say, hey, I'd really like to know what the American experience for people who are born in India looks like, let us know that and we'll send you three novels within a couple days and with links to them in our catalog.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Will you repeat what that's called again, Sarah? Because I might need to look that up myself.
Oh no, it's called What Do I Read Next? And if you're on our webpage, jmrl.org, it's about halfway down on the right hand side.
All right, I'll see you soon. So we have another question here asking: are there activities and programs that support the city or county schools now that we're in a virtual environment?
That's a great question, and it also brings up equity issues in our communities when you talk about what's available for families that aren't going to have school at least for the first 9 weeks. So the Jefferson Madison Regional Library buildings are still closed. The library board voted last week to extend curbside hours. We're going to be making an announcement tomorrow about starting next week, adding Monday evening and extending curbside hours at all locations. But the buildings are not open. So traditional library programming, which said, come in and we'll do this thing together, are not available. However, virtual programming has been a go since day one, especially on the children's end. Angela was very quick to turn around and provide the Boredom Busters in the late spring, and then to adapt our summer reading program to be online and to have virtual programming all summer long. I was shocked by one program, which there were 300 attendees for it, which of course we couldn't do in the physical library. So it's going to change the way that we do business moving forward. If 300 people want to watch it online, we have a captive audience right now, but still in the future, it's going to have to be a hybrid model. But at any rate, so the other thing that the library was able to do very quickly when shutdown happened in March was to turn on the ability to get a library card remotely, virtually. So you can get one from the library's webpage. If you don't already have a card, if you're watching this and don't have a library card, that gives you immediate access, not only to all of our online resources, our books, downloadable content, magazines, things like that, but also to the databases that JMRL provides or the state library provides in order to help the educational process too. When you're at home, you're looking for verifiable information. All that's available with your library card. If you don't have one, and of course you can't come in and get one, you can fill out one of these forms.
I also think databases is kind of a weird term to people who aren't used to using them. So if, you know, that's just online content that we pay for you to have access to. And that means that, you know, you can, instead of doing a Google search and finding, you know, 3 million hits on, you know, something on racism, then you could do a database search of the exact same thing, but it would be like, you know, vetted sources that you could trust as opposed to anything that the internet has to offer. Librarians are also, and library staff are here to help you understand how to use those. So if you ever have a question about that, We have Ask a Librarian that you can do as a chat if you're not comfortable calling. You can also text a librarian. That's also available from our website. And you can call any of your home branches that you're interested in calling and the reference department. That is what they do best. Like, they are there to help connect you with information. So if you are, you know, a student, or if you're a parent of a student that you are struggling with having, you know, finding information or learning how to delve into a subject that you're not comfortable with, we have that. And we also have homework help on our website. That's always been there, but I think it is more important than ever that people know about it. And again, there's a lot of stuff on our website. It's a very big website. It's not always the easiest to navigate because it's been around for a long time, and we are working on getting that updated as well. But your best resource is a person. So if you need help with any of our resources, we are more than happy to help you with that.
And I'd like to put a plug for services that Children's is in the process of developing. We currently do what we call a teacher pack, where we will pull books for teachers. We will do that for homeschoolers if you're teaching your kid at home. But we're also working up a list kind of on the model of What Do I Read Next? But if you need curated books, you can ask us, and we will have that form online in the next couple weeks at the latest, where you can tell us what you need, and we will pull together a list for you to look at so that you can just put holds on what you need right away. And so we're trying to find ways to be able to connect, to help give you that personalized service, even if we can't do it face-to-face.
We're getting a lot of questions like that, and just answering them on a very, like, you know, off the cuff kind of situation too. Like, a woman called and she has 3 sons, 10, 12, and 13, and she doesn't know what to get for them to read. And it's easier when you can browse, but she can't browse right now. And our catalog isn't really set up to browse the way that you can on the shelves. So, you know, she tells us things that they've liked. It works very much in the same way that What Do I Read Next does. But we'll just put them on hold for you and try to pull stuff that's specifically in our branch so you can get it sooner than it would if you had to get something from another branch. So that's something we'll do on a local basis too. I also wanted to address that because the digital divide is still a very real thing, we do offer Wi-Fi hotspots that you can still check out. So if you have connection issues, which I'm assuming that's probably not most of the people on this digital call right now, but those do exist for people who maybe don't have a steady internet connection at home, that we circulate Wi-Fi hotspots. And we also have Wi-Fi that reaches, we've put in access points, sorry, that's my kid, access points that reach further out into the into the parking lot. I'm gonna mute myself and let somebody
else. You're fine, Haley, you're fine.
Haley's right.
We've increased our wireless signal around our building so you can come near the building and use Wi-Fi, I think is what Haley was saying.
Excellent, okay. Well, I don't see any other hands or questions, so I think we can, someone did put in another comment. It's not really a question, there's another question. Can the bookmobile be used as a hotspot around the city to provide service to underserved neighborhoods or communities?
The bookmobile, as it's designed, is actually, it's a sprinter van that people can walk on. So it's got shelves on the inside, and it's designed for people to come in and have that browsing experience that Haley just mentioned. But because of that design, it's not possible to socially distance within it at all. So currently what the bookmobile is doing is providing service to some of the live-in facilities that previously the bookmobile went to. But now it's just a contactless drop-off situation. So if there's a nursing home or an assisted living facility that was a bookmobile stop, now their patrons are requesting books. The bookmobile staff are pulling them, bringing them up, dropping them off, and then taking their returns back. So that's been the main use so far. If there are needs for the bookmobile to be out and broadcast Wi-Fi, then that's certainly something that the library would be interested in helping with.
Thank you. So we had one other thought in here, and it was just a statement, I think maybe prompted by your mentioning John Lewis a little bit earlier, saying good trouble, necessary trouble, which maybe could also be part of the theme of the night.
Oh, I can't resist that. I'll put in a plug for one of my favorite books I've read recently, which is called A Good Kind of Trouble. And I cannot remember the author's name, but it's a young girl in middle school who wears an armband to school to support Black Lives Matter and the difficulty she encounters in school. And it really was a great read. So A Good Kind of Trouble.
Thank you, Angela.
Looks like it's Lisa Moore Rainey. Does that sound right?
That sounds right.
As a true librarian, I saw Haley look that up as soon as it came up. She's like, oh, I'm going to look that up. I will probably provide your answer.
Excellent. Well, you know, thank you guys again. Thank you to everyone who attended tonight for, I thought, some really great, really thoughtful questions. Thank you to the JMRL panelists for providing some really thoughtful answers. It seems like there's a lot of work to do, but we're in it together, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Siri.
Thank you, Siri.
Absolutely. Thank you, Siri.
Yes, thank you, Siri.
Thank you guys.
And thank you to our panelists also. And everyone, I will send off a video recording, a link to the YouTube video when that does get posted. I know some people were inquiring about that when they registered. So hopefully within the next day or two, I can send out the email link. All right. So I think, just some comments in here. Thanks for doing this great conversation. So impressed. Another thank you. Thank you, everybody, for attending, too.
Thank you.
Any more questions or comments? I think that might be it.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Siri.
Thank you.
A big thanks to all of the panelists for sharing their insights, and a special thank you to Siri Russell for moderating the panel. A video recording of this event can be found on the JMRL YouTube channel, and we'll include a link to that in our show notes. At the time of this recording, JMRL is currently offering contactless curbside pickup for books at all branches, Monday through Saturday. We'll link to further information about hours and procedures in our show notes. Please note that it might take a little longer than normal for your items to be ready to pick up, so we appreciate your patience while we continue to prioritize the safety and well-being of both patrons and staff. This podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or to join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org. Please hit subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to this podcast. If you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss or topics that you'd like to hear in a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org. That's all for us today. We'll be back in 2 weeks with more content. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.